This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're here with our co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Darrell, for joining us, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And we're also here because we've got quite a distinguished guest, and it is Maxwell Anderson. We're just so happy to have you, Maxwell, as our guest today. And it's our pleasure that we're hosting you. And just to give our listeners a background about you, talk to us a little bit about what you've been doing.
It's been a long time, Tony, so I don't know how much time we have.
No, just talk about the museum director, the curator,
sure.
Some of your experience, just a little bit
sure.
there.
Sure. Well, I got a doctorate in art history and went straight to work as a curator at the Metropolitan Museum, and I was there for 7 years and then moved into museum directing at the tender age of 31 and did that for 30 years.
And I thought that was maybe 10 years ago.
Well, a little yeah. No, I ended that chapter of my life in 2015 and started my new role at Souls Grown Deep. But I was a museum director thinking about the arts of the world broadly, contemporary art all the way back to the ancient world. So I've had a lot of experience across the world and across time.
And what brings you here to this show is the whole idea that you've been advocating for the inclusion of Black artists from the American South in the canon of art history. So that to me is just phenomenal. And you have this book that you've been a part of and this foundation that you're running, Souls Grown Deep, and of course the foundation. So I just want to say to you that I have a copy and this book literally brought me to tears, quite honestly, because of its depth and because of the stories about each of the artists and the work and the quality of the work and how these artists, these Black artists, were working with scraps to make art. It was just so expressive. So, Eli, you want to jump in?
Well, actually, before we went there, I had some inside baseball question about the Met. Just two. So one was, I heard that it only shows around 3% of its collection. Is that true?
I think generally most big art museums show 3 to 5%.
3 to 5%. So that's true. The other thing I want to ask, and then we'll move on to this other thing Tony brought up. I read that the collection is not on the profit and loss statements of the Met.
Right. Well, that's from an old negotiation with the IRS, which is that if you put art on the balance sheet, then you have to treat it as an asset and then you can buy and sell. And nobody wants to do that. So this was actually a good idea to take art off the balance sheet.
I understand, but that's like billions of dollars. Between
billions of dollars. Yeah. But that's true in general in art museums across the country.
And I think Darrell has some questions.
Yes. So kind of going back to what Tony was mentioning, I'm going to call you Dr. Maxwell.
No, anyway. Call me Max.
Yeah, yes, yes. I like that. Just
Dr.
Wear.
Max.
Just wants to be Max.
So you've long championed the rights of artists to receive fair tax treatment when donating different works of arts to museums, and also the rights to be able to receive royalty payments for the resale of their work as well. Have you found that your approach to this topic differs from other contemporaries of yours who might, you know, maybe oppose even that viewpoint?
Oh, that's a great question, Darrell, because there are a lot of leading museum trustees who aren't crazy about the idea of paying artists royalties. They figure that's just going to drive the price up that I have to pay. And my point of view is patent holders and others in the creative industries, including in the world of radio and television and film, get paid royalties. But guess who doesn't? Visual artists. And there's no real reason for that. And I think it's been time for many years to change that. And the hope is that at some point Congress will get behind it.
Invariably also trustees are collectors too, to a large extent, aren't they? Some of them?
Sure. And I think it's a natural impulse to say, I don't want to shave off anything that I don't have to pay. But the predicament for artists is a lot of artists who start as a mid-career success discover that their early work sold for a penny on the dollar and then it's resold for a lot and they don't benefit from it.
You know, this interesting point that you're raising, but I'm thinking about your work as a director of the Whitney and thinking about diversity, equity, inclusion, because that is the conversation that we've been having very robustly since COVID. Talk about how you worked in that space and what kinds of resistances, or did you come across resistances when you were working towards making art just really accessible and also from a staffing point of view as well.
It's interesting you brought that up because okay. there's a, and if you don't mind, Max.
No, that's all right.
There's a classic Whitney Biennial, Sussman and also Thelma Golden put together.
1993,
where they put a reading room, which was heresy at that time. And but that was a way to make it more accessible. And there was a lot of pushback against that, right? So that's a case in point.
Mm-hmm. Well, pushback is normal, certainly at the Whitney and a lot of museums. I had the experience of working with artists in the Deep South when I moved there in 87, and including all the artists that work in the Foundation's collection. So when I got to the Whitney, I was eager to continue to show their work, as I had done for the previous many years. And I brought Thornton Dial into the Whitney Biennial in the year 2000. And then we did the Quilts of G's Bend show at the Whitney in 2002, which is a long time ago. And there was a lot of resistance to that. And partly because, as the question was put to me by one of my supporters, how many mid-career artists have not had a retrospective at the Whitney? And I said, that is a long list. And he said, so why are you showing quilts from Alabama?
Interesting.
And I said, because it's American art. Mm-hmm. So I think that impulse to push out artists who don't come from a classically trained context and experience, that bias was evident then and now, and I think it's what we try to work to change.
So my question would be, so what is it that's driving you? Because I read the preface that you wrote, and you talked a lot about slavery and, you know, the extraction of wealth from African Americans. And I look at you, now this is my lens. I'm looking at you and saying, why?
You're looking at my pigmentation.
Yes,
and you're
I
saying,
am.
What's going
I
on am. Here?
I'm, yeah. I'm looking at you being a white man and saying to myself, wow.
Well, I guess it comes from DNA. My grandfather was a playwright, and he wrote a musical that was on Broadway with an extraordinary score about apartheid. And it was on stage in 1947 and ran for, you know, long time. And so I grew up in a household that valued social justice and racial justice. My mother was very concerned at my school here in New York that there weren't other black families. There's one black family. She said, why is there only one black family? So I grew up in a household that valued that topic, and it never really left me. So in the art world, I've always looked at artists in terms of advocacy. And in this case, living in the South as I did for 8 years, I became very attached to this story, to these artists, and to the fact that they were underappreciated and unseen in the Northeast, the Midwest, and the West.
You know, sometimes, Max, I know it can feel like you're on an island unto yourself when, you know, amongst colleagues talking about some of these issues. How have you navigated museum spaces in particular, incredibly successfully, might I add, like for so many years at a time when the field at large wasn't even talking about some of these issues? I mean, you're going back to the 80s.
With right. Like, I was right. listening to 1987.
Like, I mean, the museum.
Well, actually, 1940s.
Right. you know, a lot of museum curators and directors are just now really starting to jump into this conversation around this. So what was that like for you?
Look, I can't take any credit for that. I'm looking at art from the lens of an art historian. I'm interested in history. I'm interested in the contemporary art world. And I've always been fascinated by artists who were underappreciated and wondered why, if I found their work compelling and powerful. So I think in the U.S. museum space, the topic of diversity was around for many years, but George Floyd's murder catalyzed a sense of urgency and a kind of guilt, I guess, on the part of a lot of administrators, museum directors, and curators to say, whoops, we have to start reflecting a set of values that haven't been evident. And that has changed the conversation decisively, of course.
So I just want to, just thinking back to when you first started the Souls Grown Deep Foundation. So you're the person who sort of got it going and stuff like that.
Well, just to be clear, I didn't start it. I was on the board when it began. And William Arnett, Bill Arnett, was a collector in Georgia who began acquiring this work through his travels around the Deep South. And I met Bill in 87 and joined him on trips and got to know these artists because of his collection, which was astonishing. So Bill agreed at that time to donate the best of his work into a foundation named Souls Grown Deep. And I joined the board shortly thereafter. And when I left the Dallas Museum of Art as director in 2015, I took over the presidency of the foundation.
Now, these artists are, for the most part, they're living in poverty, I would say, you know, because from what I could tell by reading this book, you know, some of them are living in remote, isolated places that were made remote intentionally because of lack of ferry service, you know, where the town might say, let's just leave those Black people over there. What can you do to help these artists to really have a sustainable future in this work that they're doing?
Yeah, well, there are three great questions bound up in that. Oh. So bear in mind that when the Great Migration unfolded, a lot of creative people moved. They moved out of the South. But the artists in our collection did not. They stayed there for various reasons. And as a result, there is a quality to their work that you may feel is different from what is seen in the big galleries in the Northeast and LA and so on. But bear in mind, when we talk about found materials, some of the greatest artists in the marketplace use found materials.
It's very innovative, is it not?
But
is it
just Robert innovative? Rauschenberg, right. Jasper Johns, yeah. Kunelis, you know, Keenholz, these mm-hmm. artists who are top market performers also make work from found materials. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call them scraps. They're just found materials.
Okay.
So I think that there's no real distinction between these artists and those high, you know, high value artists other than bias.
It goes all the way back.
Interesting.
It goes all the way back to the Duchamp.
Kind of pointing that it is a bias, right. But anyway.
Well, that was, it was at the time it was shocking. Mm-hmm. The ready-mades was shocking. But it's the same. It's the same thing.
Yeah, Marcel Duchamp kicked it off with his urinal called Fountain back at the beginning of the 20th century and called this is a work of art. And so it changed the dynamic of the art. So I think we have to look at these artists in a larger context of all artists who use materials that are available to them in whatever way.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to the delightful, informative, and groundbreaking Max Anderson.
So, Max, you know, we've been talking about Souls Grown Deep and the foundation, and we've also talked about your positionality as a white man leading this foundation. Do you see or foresee a time when it might be more beneficial for the foundation for you to actually step back and let someone Black lead the organization?
Absolutely. I have no sense that I'm the right person to do it. I'm simply doing it, and I've been doing it for 7 years and enjoying it and doing my very best. But back to what Tony raised around supporting artists, that's really my focus, is what's the possibility of economic benefit to the communities that gave rise to these artists. And it's with that in mind that the foundation has given over $1 million to the community in G's Bend in the last couple of years, that we've been working to create jobs. We've created dozens of jobs in Alabama for artists. We've seen this topic of royalties implemented in the provision of a resale royalty award program that we've set up where we pay 5% of the resale value. So I'm not by any means the only person who could be doing this. I'm simply doing it. And until such time as the board feels it's time for a change, I'll keep doing it.
Love that. And I do want to say too, there, you know, being from Alabama originally, one, I definitely appreciate the economic development that you're doing there with artists. But also there's something to be said for using your privilege for the good of others. And I think that's a really important distinction to make. While you are in that position, you're using what you have to really provide a pathway for other people in a very deep way. No pun on the organization itself.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
we exemplary, quite honestly.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. But knowing all these museum directors since I did it for 3 decades, we've been able to move over 500 works of art from our collection into the permanent collections of over 30 museums with works by 110 artists. And so that is what I've been able to contribute because of the connections and the degree to which working with those colleagues before I had an entree.
So, you know, typically when you think about, when people speak about the Black South, those conversations are usually grounded in things like melancholy and sadness and pain. But that's not the full gamut of emotions that these artists portray. How do you see them expanding that sort of dialogue, if you will, or conversation with other kind of aspects like joy or beauty or addition to?
My board chair, Mary Margaret Petway, is a fourth generation G's Bend quiltmaker. And I think if you were to have said to her, what about sadness? And she'd say, what are you talking about? I'm living this life with my children in a place that I literally grew up in and love. And her work is jubilant. Her work as a quilt maker is expressive and full of all sorts of values. So I don't know that I would look to these artists to be any particular point of view. They're all individuals like any other artist. They all bring their own view of the world into their work. And whether it's Lonnie Holly or Thornton Dial or Ronald Lockett, they all had their own forms of expression that were individuated and based on their own life experience.
Where can we see this work? Because you've got me ready. I am ready to go. I know it was in UK, right? You know, there was an exhibit there in Great Britain, I believe.
Yes, it's still up.
Yeah.
Souls Grown Deep Like the Rivers. That's the catalog you have.
Right.
And the National Gallery of Art has a show right now, which has been extended through December 31st, 2023, which includes over 40 works of art that they acquired from us a couple of years ago. But among the 32 museums that have acquired work from Souls Grown Deep since 2015 or so, a lot of them are on display. Philadelphia Museum of Art, Boston, the museums in Dallas, across the country, we have collections that represent these artists now that didn't have their work before we started our work.
Yeah, these are in the permanent collections. So in your role in the Met, and I guess around that time, you did a lot of work around antiquities, Roman and Greek, yeah? And then some of them, I imagine, went out for exhibits, traveling exhibits, things like that. So just want to talk a little bit about the challenges about negotiating these priceless artifacts. And is there any kind of war stories you'd love to tell about that? Doesn't get you in trouble, though.
No, that's all right. It's clearly an area that's very controversial because a lot of the material in museums in this country were looted. They were stolen out of the ground.
They're being repatriated, right?
Yeah. And a lot of them are going back now. When I was a curator at the Metropolitan Museum, the collection very much was filled with this type of material that had problematic histories, and a lot of those are being addressed today. And over the years, I tried to work to the restitution of those materials, and when I was director in the Dallas Museum of Art, I restituted works to Italy and to Turkey that were shown to have been looted. So I think it's very much upon the responsibilities of directors and curators to be mindful of the legal, ethical, moral issues surrounding ownership of objects that simply don't belong to them.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was reminding me of a story when I was in London in the V&A, Victoria and Albert Museum. I'm not sure if you're familiar, they have a room of all these casts of these old, temples and stuff from the ancient world. And we ran into the curator of that thing who was walking around the gallery. And he said something very interesting that a lot of ways, because these casts were done so long ago, they're actually better representation of the temples because the ones in the actual places were deteriorated by acid rain.
Exactly. The Met has a huge collection of plaster casts. And when I was there, I actually oversaw the loan of 90 of them to Munich, to the Institute for Classical Archaeology, exactly because they weren't subjected to weathering. And so their condition on the surface was better than the originals today.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Max Anderson.
Now, I want to dig a little bit into your work as a museum curator and director. Talk to us about how museums stay relevant. How do they make sure that they are reaching out to a broad audience and that they're bringing people in and they're not viewed as that unwelcoming place that maybe I go to because I've got a term paper to do, but it's not really a part of a community, so to speak.
Especially with teens, because you tell teens that we're going to a museum that you think you're asking them to redo their math homework.
Yeah, well, two of the museums I directed had admission fees when I started, and I asked the board to consider removing those fees, which we did, and it led to a surge in attendance and diversification of our audiences. In Dallas, we actually got to a majority-minority audience
after a while.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the first barrier. People think about museums, certainly in New York City here, that rates to go into some of our finer institutions are punishing, $30. And I think broadly the challenge for museums in staying important to their communities is that their front door is open. And for most of them, the wealth they have is sufficient not to have to charge that kind of admission rate. The second thing is to look at their collections and programs in ways that attach to the lives of people who might visit. And these days, there's a lot of challenge around that because the market, the art market, is driving the calendar to a certain extent of what's popular, what's going to flip the turnstile, rather than what's going to open a conversation and open people's hearts and minds. And it's very challenging to run museums today for that reason.
So, Max, you also serve, along with the work that you're doing as president with Souls Grown Deep, as the COO of LMI Group International and CEO of NC3. So these tech incubators that are really advancing technological development and like data science and scientific computing. So in this sort of like tech space, you know, especially thinking about the social justice compass that you have, how are you also, you know, integrating those two things and providing spaces for people of color within sort of like that cross section of the industry?
Yeah, well, I got interested in things digital in the mid 90s and wrote the introduction to a book called The Wired Museum, which is now, you know, 30 years old.
Another book, right?
And the company I work for has an opportunity now, which we're really excited about in Barbados. And the project is pretty remarkable. The Prime Minister hired us to look at the fact that they have tens of millions of pages of records of the transatlantic slave trade. Mm. We're digitizing every page.
Wow.
We're going to work with Sir David Adjaye, the architect who built it.
Yes. He's doing work at the Innovation Campus right here in Bed-Stuy.
Yeah. And I'll see David in Venice in a few days.
Can I go?
Yeah, right? Can you believe that?
Well, he's
synchronicities.
He's showing the work that we're doing in Barbados, which is to build a memorial to the enslaved, first of all, and secondly, a heritage district. So the goal is over time to create hundreds of jobs for Bajans on island, training them in the field of digital technology, scanning, metadata extraction, and so on, and allow this material to become part of the common knowledge of the world as the single largest resource outside of Britain for the history of the trade in enslaved people.
Mm. That's pretty stunning.
Amazing.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Good question.
Now I'm kind of going back a little, though, because I wanted to know, how do you feel about controversy when it comes to museums and art? Because I know sometimes that works. You have a very controversial exhibit. Where do you land in that?
Yeah, you're talking to the master of controversy.
Yeah. Well, see, and I want to be vulnerable because, you know, this is sort of new landscape for me.
Look, I think
is it a tool? But is it a tool? Is it something that people use to attract?
Well, I don't think you should strive to do that. Mm-hmm. I think that it's inevitable that creative expression can rub some people the wrong way. And today the world is on tenterhooks. Everybody's afraid of alienating
what
and upsetting
this?
Everybody
we can't,
else.
We just can't talk to each other very well
right.
anymore.
Everyone's afraid of offending each other.
Right.
So that shuts down communication. That's not a good thing. And I think artists are the people who lead us to the right conversations. They're the ones who make possible free expression and open communication. And I'm not afraid of controversy, because controversy just means having an opportunity for dialogue. And if all we want is pleasing the eye or something, you're not going to get any benefit from that other than like meringue. It's sweet, but it provides no sustenance.
Junk food.
Mm-hmm. I think when I think about that question is that I don't think Max looked for controversy, but he had courage in the work that he did and just sort of followed it.
Well, I had a run-in with his esteemed honor, Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor, because the Whitney Biennial had a work in it by Hans Hacke.
Oh, yeah, I remember
And
that.
Hans had done it in response to the Brooklyn Museum's funding being pulled when a work by the extraordinary artist Chris Ofili showed the Madonna.
Elephant feces. That's what I was thinking
right.
about. Oh, my
and
gracious.
So
right.
Giuliani yanked our permit for banners on Madison Avenue to promote the Whitney Biennial in retaliation. So I think, to me, that's the sort of controversy that may happen when someone who's not that informed about the arts, as Giuliani was not, comes at it with anger and aggression and a failure to understand really what was behind the work to start with.
Now, one might say that there needed to be more education around the work.
Well, sometimes it's
before. I mean, I'm just wondering, because that was a big thing back in the, I think it was in the 90s.
99.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's also just political theater.
True.
It's like
true.
Brownie points. You know what I mean?
Well, for the artist, elephant dung is a sacred material.
But not everybody knew that.
Well, but true. But again, I think that's incumbent on us as the audience to inform ourselves before we start barking.
I definitely hear that.
And before you immediately accuse or shout, learn something about.
But do you think that's people really? I found that we're in a phase now where people just seem to just kind of don't need to learn. They just have an opinion.
That's correct. That's where we are. Everyone has an opinion. And as Senator Moynihan used to say, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Max, I'm thinking about something. You know, we kind of talked about attracting the younger generation into museums. So I'm thinking about the work of Sandra Jackson Dumont and what she was able to do at the Met with Teens Take the Met. What can the field do to start to market and attract the younger generations to come in beyond just like the school field trip? You know, what can we do to really like deeply engage and actually put on work that they're interested in and, you know, revolutionary idea, maybe even featuring young artists within these spaces as well?
Yeah. Sandra and I worked together at the
Whitney. I know.
I think the world of her. She's an incredible leader. Amazing. She was a great educator, and now she's a great director of the Lucas Museum in Los Angeles. Look, the strategies to get to young people is to have young people involved and have them involved as docents, as people leading tours, as people participating in programs, as being visible on the museum's website and podcasts, and being, in effect, a voice. And there are so many young people who are excited about the arts who can introduce their peers into a field they might not know about. So I think it's as simple as putting a microphone or a camera in front of a young person and asking them to explain, why are you passionate about this? What excites you about it? Rather than having somebody of a certain age, like myself, try to make that palpable.
You know, it's amazing how many people in the field of a certain generations complain about not reaching younger generations, but they're not in the design process.
That's right.
And it's interesting, I think back of all the sessions I've been at, like the millions of conferences, one of the most memorable one was ASTEC, Association of Science and Technology Center. And it was a brilliant panel where they had a group of teenagers on the panels as panelists. And the people in the audience who were professional were presenting their projects and they were critiquing it. And I think a lot of ways that's really missing a lot mm-hmm. of the development process. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things we talk about on the show, this idea that we're on the cusp of a new renaissance, which I know is in a lot of ways a Eurocentric view of it, but so be it. And as you know, that renaissance means rebirth. And at the time, it was the Catholic Church, you know, losing power because of the pandemic and therefore allowed secularism and individualism to rise. And so we have fertile ground for that. In a lot of ways, I believe that's happening now. And this idea about breakdown, breakthrough, you're starting to see that with artificial intelligence and other things. Could you talk a little bit about that? What's your perspective on it?
Well, I'm excited about artificial intelligence. I mean, to me, that world is terrifying and exciting because it opens up the possibility for new ways of perceiving things we've already seen but haven't perceived. And I would expect that there'll be a lot of disruption around this, that there'll be jobs lost, professions changed, people's attitudes challenged. But in the end, human advancement is human advancement. Machines are taught by people. And if there's a need for change down the road to ratchet down the exposure to how AI is changing the economy or opportunities, I think regulation will step in and people will step in out of their own conscience. But it definitely is going to be the Wild West for a while as we get used to this.
But don't you think in some ways it's sort of a break in this legacy that's going on for hundreds of years about paint on canvas and, you know, rehashing a lot of ideas and...
I don't know. I tend to think Heraclitus used to say that life is like standing in a stream and the water's just rushing past you, which is in effect where we are. I think it's always been a time of change. There's never been a point in human history when there hasn't been change, including the Middle Ages, which a lot of people assume was the Dark Ages, but it was a vibrant, exciting time as well. So I tend to be of the sense that history teaches us every period is filled with raucous, exciting change, and you have to grab onto it and do your best to live through it.
I have to say, just listening to you, you're so positive. You know, you're quietly positive, but so very positive. And I just appreciate your coming on Art Moves, Max, and sharing all your insights and for the great work that you're doing with Souls Grown Deep. Also, just for your spirit. And also the way that you're living your life. I just so appreciate
it.
So thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Koslansky and our distinguished co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.